Afterwards, brought me to the temple. That's the millennial temple. This is a vision that God gave Ezekiel of the millennial temple, and measured the post 6 cubits broad on the one side and 6 cubits broad on the other side, which was the breadth of the tabernacle. And we've been looking at the noticeable differences between the Old Testament tabernacle and the Old Testament temples and this millennial temple. And we've pointed out several. And the differences, they definitely describe some interesting details that we can grasp hold of. For instance, there's no wall of partition to exclude Gentiles. In the Old Testament temple, there was partitions that excluded Gentiles from entering. And in the millennial temple, there'd be no such thing. There's no veil. Well, that's important. No veil between the front room and the back room of the tabernacle. Most of you know that veil was there to isolate the back room where the Ark of the Covenant was, where God resided, unlike he resided anyplace else on the earth. And so this veil separated or isolated God from everybody else, and the only person that could go inside that veil was the high priest once per year to represent people. So they had a priest that represented folks, and he could only go once per year, and not without blood. He had to go with blood as a sacrifice for the sins of the people. And yet when Jesus died, it was the eternal sacrifice forever, once and for all. And so that veil was torn down, giving us, as Brother Nichols often says, all of us are priests, Revelation 1, 5, and 6, all of us are priests, which means we have direct access to God, so there'll be no veil in the millennial temple, no laver. Remember the washing of the hands, the priests would wash their hands and their feet before they'd go do their service, no table of showbread. We talk a little bit about bread, Jesus himself called himself the bread of life, and there's going to be no table of showbread because Jesus himself will be there. We mentioned no lampstand or a menorah. When we were talking about that lamp, we talked about the coverings of the tabernacle. It's important when you think about the menorah or the lampstand, because inside the temple, the light that was in there was that lampstand. And so all the pieces of furniture in that front room, they could not be seen unless that light was shining. And it was shining all the time. God commanded them to have it on all of the time. But we talked about the coverings. It was pretty good. It was an interesting study last week. Badger's skin, the very outside, the most outside covering was badger's skin. Exodus 26:14 says a covering above of badger's skins. The most outer layer, then, the outer material, was badger's skin. And we said it was probably because God probably did this to give it as an outside cover because of its durability and its toughness and its long-wearing ability out in the arid desert conditions. Now, it was rather benign on the outside, rather regular, rather drab, but we mentioned that pictured the humanity of Jesus. Everything in the tabernacle pictures Jesus. The Old Testament, when we look at the Old Testament and see these the tabernacle, everything in there was a picture or a type or a shadow of the Lord Jesus. And the coverings are no different. The outside cover shows this drab, regular, rather benign picture of the humanity of Jesus. He's 100% God, but he came 100% man. He chose to put off his deity while here. He chose to lay aside his deity. Philippians 2:6 mentions it this way, who being in the form of God thought it not robbery to be equal with God. And it wasn't robbery because he was. But verse 7 says, but made himself of no reputation. If you look up the word made himself of no reputation, if you look up those words and figure out what it means this. The Thayer's lexicon defines it this way, empty or void. He emptied himself of deity, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. And so he emptied himself of his deity. I was thinking about this, and as I was reviewing this past week of the stuff we talked about last time, I got thinking about this. You know, Jesus, he came to the earth. I mean, God came to earth in humanity, in human form. I was thinking there's a TV program on, I don't know if it's still on, it used to be on, Undercover Boss, where CEOs would actually present themselves as a regular employee. One I was reading about, there's a fellow by the name of Brad Bandini. This is back in 2015. He disguised himself as a janitor trainee. And once the janitor that was training him found out who he was, he thought, oh, no, I told him all this bad stuff about his company. But it availed them to a side of the company that they couldn't see any other way. So they had to disguise themselves as a regular employee so they could see it from the regular employee's perspective. You know, from the CEO's perspective, the company looks a lot different than from the bottom. Well, that's exactly what Jesus did. He came and disguised himself as man. God came and disguised himself as man and lived in a man's body. Hebrews 2:14 says, "For as much then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise took part of the same that through death," I like the way the Bible puts that, through death. It doesn't say by death. It says through death, because he didn't stay there. "That through death he might destroy him that had the power of death," that is the devil. He came to represent humanity, to typify humanity, to stand for us, all mankind, the human race. So the badger skin shows his rugged humanity. Then we looked at the ram's skins dyed red. Again, Exodus 26:14, "Thou shalt make a covering for the tent of ram skins dyed red." We mentioned ram. An adult female sheep is called a ewe lamb, but an adult male sheep is called a ram, an adult sheep. So God used a ram or an adult male sheep to show Jesus in his vicarious position as our go-between, the one that stood in our place and died in our place. In John 1:36, looking upon Jesus as he walked, John the Baptist said this, "Behold, the Lamb of God." So a ram then dyed red. I don't even think we have to explain that too much, but Leviticus 17:11 says, for the life of the flesh is in the blood. And the last part of the verse says, "For it is the blood that maketh an atonement," or a covering, "for sin." So badger skin, ram skins dyed red, goat's hair was the third one. As we're moving closer unto the inside, Exodus 26:7, "Thou shalt make curtains of goat's hair." So goat's hair, we mentioned last week about the scapegoat and the sacrificial goat. Once again, ain't much need to explain it much, but Jesus, he's our scapegoat. He's our sacrifice. He's our stand-in for us. And then finally, the inside portion of the coverings was the fine twined linen. From the inside out, the first layer that you could see from the inside out, that first layer was this fine twined linen, and by far the most beautiful and the most majestic and the most magnificent layer. Again, Exodus 26 and verses 1 through about 14 tells about the layers. "Moreover, thou shalt make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twined linen, and blue and purple and scarlet, and cherubims of cunning work shalt thou make on them." So the inner covering, that initial covering from the inside out, is this fine twined linen with blue, purple, and red images of cherubims. And we mentioned that linen shows the righteousness, Jesus' righteousness. And then the colors are important. Those colors, the embroidered colors on that fine twined linen, according to this type, blue is heavenly. You know, like the blue sky where Jesus came from. Purple is kingly or royal, shows Jesus' royalty. And then scarlet, red, redemption. So, and then we brought the point around, at least to try to last week, the menorah, that candelabra, that lampstand, those candlesticks were the form of light that were inside that tabernacle so that when they walked in, I mean, they had all these covers keeping all the light out. And so inside, the only light that they had, as far as physical light goes, is this lampstand. And the only reason they could see the table of showbread and the other thing we're going to talk about today, the golden altar of incense, is because of this light. And all those picture Jesus. And they had the light. You know, Jesus is the light of the world. They had that light to show them all that stuff. And we mentioned, you know, when Jesus, when we get saved, Jesus moves inside. You know, Christ in us, the hope of glory. He's inside us. And so he shows us from the inside out. This Jesus. We have that inside, and we can see Jesus from the inside out by Jesus being inside. So anyway, that's where we've come to. So we've talked about no wall partition, no veil, no laver, no table of showbread, no lampstand. And then finally, this one, no golden altar of incense. No golden altar of incense. Again, you have to ask the question, well, what's the golden altar of incense? If there's not going to be one in the millennial temple, and there was one in the Old Testament temple, there must have been something that it represented. So we want to look and see how see what the golden altar of incense is all about. In order to really understand that, you kind of get a view in your head about what the tabernacle looked like and what the temple looked like. There was two rooms. There was a front room and a back room. So you got these two rooms. The front room was usually called the holy place, and the back room was usually called the holiest of all, or the holy of holies. So, and the front room is where the priest would go in and do their service before God daily. They'd go in every day and do their services for God every day. The back room, again, was that place where only the high priest would go once per year beyond the veil that separated that front room from the back room. So those two rooms are separated by this veil. Remember, we talked about that, the 11-layer, 4-inch-thick curtain. So that separated the front room and the back room. Now, when entering the holy place, when you'd walk in from the front door, and you'd be walking into the front door of the first room, the front room, as you walked in, on your right side would be the table of showbread. So when you walk in, the first thing you'd see on the right side is the table of showbread, and on the left side would be the golden lampstand. Now, that's in the Old Testament, because in the New Testament, we've talked about those. They're not going to be in the Millennial Temple, because they typify Jesus, and Jesus is going to be in the Millennial Temple. He's going to have his throne, his seat of governmental authority. He's going to be sitting in the Millennial Temple. So we don't need all this stuff, because he's going to be there himself. This all typifies him. He's going to personify it in the Millennial Temple. But so you got what's on the right hand, what's on the left hand, but straight ahead. Straight ahead, just in front of that veil, was the golden altar of incense. So straight ahead at the back of the front room was this golden altar of incense. Now, although the curtain, the veil, kept all out from the Holy of Holies. So you got the front room, the back room, this veil there, and the veil kept everybody out of the back room. When they set up the incense, when they burned the incense, we'll talk about that word burn in a minute, it's an important word, but when they burned or they offered up or they lit up the incense, the sweet fragrance would permeate, would totally fill, would penetrate, would saturate the entire tabernacle. My children used to live in Lubbock. Have you ever lived in Lubbock? God bless y'all. Y'all fortunate. Lubbock. Anybody know what the one thing Lubbock is famous for? That when you go to Lubbock, you can close all the doors, you can seal all the windows up, you can tighten everything up. I mean, you can get the best craftsman in the world to build all your doors and build all your windows. Guess what still gets in? sand. No matter what you do, sand, it gets into everything. Now, we were only up there a few times when my kids were up there, but we figured that out real fast. And anybody that's ever lived in Lubbock, they know sand. It gets in no matter what you do. Well, that's kind of the idea of this incense. When you light the incense, it just gets into every nook and cranny of the entire tabernacle, which included that back room where God was. Exodus 30, verse 6 says, "Now shalt put it before the veil," talking about this golden altar, "that is by the ark of the testimony, before the mercy seat that is over the testimony, where I will meet with thee. And Aaron shall burn thereon sweet incense every morning. When he dresseth the lamps, he shall burn incense upon it." So Aaron or a priest would go in every morning, and they'd light up that incense. And it's interesting that God mentions here that it's right before the Ark of the Covenant. Now, they couldn't see the Ark of the Covenant because that veil was there. That veil was there, so they couldn't see it. But still, God mentions it in verse 6, "And thou shalt put it before the veil that is by the Ark of the Testimony," or Ark of the Covenant, "before the mercy seat that is over the testimony, where I will meet with thee." God mentions that when he's talking about where to put this golden altar of incense, because the golden altar of incense is the closest thing, as far as furniture goes, in the entire tabernacle to the Ark of the Covenant. It's right there. Just that veil separates it, and when the incense goes up, it fills the entire tabernacle. So incense was lit, and God would smell the sweet scent of the incense when it go up. I was reading about incense when I was looking about this. It's used for a whole bunch of reasons. I was kind of surprised, actually. But common purpose are, I just mentioned a few of them, to meditate. People use incense so they can sit and think. Years ago, when I was in the military, that was like another lifetime ago, people in the military used to use incense back then too. And they light it, and that way they could just, you know, and they play their music loud and they drift off into oblivion. Well, yeah, to meditate, to unwind, to encourage emotional release. I just need some emotional release. I just need to sit and relax for a little bit. To get inspired, to revamp your routine, to heighten awareness, to nurture a sense of self. Isn't that a blessing? To heal, to soothe. So all these things that people are using incense for today. But if you think about it, it's all about setting a mood, getting a person in the proper frame of mind to create an atmosphere. Well, that's exactly what this incense was doing before God. They would have this incense going up, and God said he would smell the fragrance, the aroma, the bouquet of this sweet savor that he had told them to do. So they would burn this incense. I was looking at the words sweet savor. So those two words joined together. There's only 44 verses in the entire Bible where sweet savor as a clause is found in the entire Bible. 43 are in the Old Testament. There's one in the New. But the idea is it's creating this atmosphere before God, and God can smell it. Now, I want to look at a few things about this sweet savor and get this idea. When they burned this incense, it was for man, but it was more for God. So he could smell this sweet savor of their service or their sacrifice before him. God could have a sweet savor before him when people offered things to him. The first time we find it in the Bible is a result from Noah making an offering after the episode in the ark. Genesis 8:21, "And the Lord smelled a sweet savor, And the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite anymore every living thing as I have done. So Noah here, he had an offering and put this offering up before God, and God smelled a sweet savor. Result of this sacrifice before God. So Noah offered his sacrifice before God, and the result was a sweet savor before God. And it actually, from what that says, moved God that he'd never destroyed the entire earth like he did that time. See, it says, and the Lord smelled a sweet savor, and the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake. Does that look to you like it does to me, like it was the sweet savor that pushed him that way? Now, I know God knows everything, and he already knew he was going to do this, but the idea is this sweet savor before God, it moves God. The second time is, we see it, is rams sacrificed before the Lord. Exodus 29:18, and thou shalt burn the whole ram upon the altar. It is a burnt offering unto the Lord. It is a sweet savor, an offering made by fire unto the Lord. These are instructions of how to sanctify and designate and set apart Aaron and the Levitical priesthood. It didn't actually happen until later on in the book of Leviticus, but God was just giving the instructions in Exodus, how are you going to do it? This is how it's going to happen, and they later did it in Leviticus. But what I want to look at in light of this, now this sweet savor that goes before God, moves God, I want to get an idea of this word burnt. Burnt. Leviticus 1:9 says it this way, but his inwards and his legs shall he wash in water. This is the sacrificial animal they're going to offer up. And the priest shall burn all on the altar to be a burnt sacrifice, an offering made by fire of a sweet savor unto the Lord. Notice how it says burn all on the altar and to be a burnt sacrifice. The word burn, now I wouldn't have known this, except you know when you read and you study, you find stuff. You know how they say the Bible is so shallow that even a child can understand, but so deep that theologians have a difficult time sometimes. The Bible's deep. This idea of burn and burnt, it's important in the Old Testament. It's an important word. Sometimes it's translated burn, sometimes it's translated burnt, sometimes it's translated burnt incense. All those are the same word that it comes from, and the word seems to carry the meaning, the result, or the product of the aroma rather than just the burning. Dr. Albert Barnes, I like reading behind him. He's a Baptist preacher from years ago, several centuries ago, actually. Several centuries. It's from Barnes Notes. Maybe you've heard the name of his by Barnes Notes. Burn exclusively is used for burnt offerings and burnt incense. And it pictures more so the aroma or the scent or the smell than the actual burning itself. So it's the product of what it's doing. Sometimes you can walk outside a neighborhood and you go, man, especially on a weekend, ooh, that smells good. Somebody's barbecuing. Somebody's got their cooker going. Somebody's got their grill going, and you can smell the brisket, or you can smell some type of meat that they're cooking outside. The entire neighborhood can smell it and sense the aroma and can breathe in the flavor of that meat. Man, I think I want to go meet my neighbor. Smells good. Well, that word burn, again, carries the idea more about the odor than the act of the cooking, and it focuses on the smell, that sweet odor, that pleasant fragrance to the nose. And again, it's used in the offerings before the Lord as well as offering incense. The word burnt. And so the idea is God is being moved. by this fragrance that's coming up before him. God is moved by the burning of sacrifices. God is moved by the burning of incense. So the offering before the Lord, and then sweet incense. We get to the incense itself, Exodus 39, 38, and the golden altar, and the anointing oil, and the sweet incense, and the hanging for the tabernacle door. Exodus 40, 27 puts it this way, and he burnt sweet incense thereon, as the Lord commanded Moses. And again, all this is going up, and it's filling the entire tabernacle, moving God. We can also see it portrayed in Solomon's temple, 2 Chronicles 2:4. Behold, I build an house to the name of the Lord my God, to dedicate it to him and to burn before him sweet incense, and for the continual showbread and for the burnt offerings morning and evening on the Sabbaths and on the new moons and on the solemn feast of the Lord our God. This is an ordinance forever to Israel. So you see the burning of the sweet incense, and it also mentions the burning of offerings. And again, this idea of burning, Barnes pointed out that it has more to do with the scent that's coming off than it does actually the burning itself, because it's moving God. 1 Chronicles 13:11, and they burn unto the Lord every morning and every evening burnt sacrifices and sweet incense. So let me set this up for you. You come home from a hard day work. Well, you've been working hard and slaving hard. Your mind's been going 100 miles an hour, and you walk home, or you get out the car, walk the door, and you open the door, and you go, man, somebody's been cooking. I'm getting hungry. You getting hungry? I've been talking about food. I'm getting hungry. You come home. Wife's been cooking. You know she's been slaving over that stove. Maybe it's one of my favorites. Maybe it's stew. I like stew. I can eat some stew. Some meatloaf. Some hamburgers. You know that red meat, that bad stuff for you. But the entire house can be filled with the smell of the food, and that's the same idea, this idea of this burnt sacrifice and the burnt incense. The entire place is filled with this fragrance, and that fragrance moves God. That's important to remember. You got to think about that, because as we get in the New Testament, it makes a difference. So the offering before the Lord, the sweet incense, and then we get into the New Testament, and again, recall in the Old Testament, God was represented inside that holy of all, the holiest of all, the holy of holies place. And the only representation that man had was they had to go through priests once per year. Now, there was daily offerings, and so the burnt sacrifice and the burnt incense would be offered, and God would smell that. But the only time they could go inside and actually meet with God, one person, once per year, inside. Well, by the time we get to the New Testament, Jesus comes to earth in his body. He comes to us. He comes to us, and he becomes the ultimate, final sacrifice. Jesus' sacrifice is portrayed this way in Ephesians 5:2, and walk in love as Christ also hath loved us and hath given himself for us an offering. And a sacrifice to God, watch this now, for a sweet-smelling savor. He offered himself before God as a sweet-smelling savor. Moving God by that sacrifice. So the Old Testament sacrifices, including the incense, depicted and typified and was a shadow of Jesus. We get to Jesus, and he offers himself on the cross as that sweet savor for us. And then we can look at some Christian sacrifices, several areas. Earl Bach talked about this the other night, giving. Philippians 4:8, but I have all and abound, and I am full, and having received of Epaphroditus the things which were sent from you, an odor of a sweet smell, a sacrifice acceptable, well-pleasing to God. When you give to missions, when you give for meetings, when you give the needs of others, God smells it. God smells it. He smells that sweet savor, your sacrifice before him, witnessing and showing Jesus in our lives. 2 Corinthians 2:15, for we are unto God a sweet savor of Christ, in them that are saved and in them that perish. He says, we as Christians become a sweet savor amongst others, both saved and lost. And in verse 16 qualifies it and says, to the one, we are the savor of death unto death. To the lost, we're savor of death unto death. And to the other, the savor of life unto life. And who is sufficient for all these things? The sweet savor before the Lord. You know, we go with our regular duties through the day. Not just when we're soul winning, but any time in our day, when we're a good worker, when we show our responsibilities, we end up being there on time, we do a good day's work, we're showing Jesus. We're showing a good testimony, a good worker, a good witness, a good way of life, and God portrays that as a sweet savor, sweet savor, and so the Christian can have that as well. So the offerings before the Lord, the sweet incense in the New Testament. And then finally, we look at tonight, this morning, our prayers. Our prayers. I had another stop with Zechariah, but we're going to have to go without Zechariah. We'll have to leave Zechariah behind. But our prayers. Our prayers, when in Revelation, we get over to Revelation. In fact, I think Mike read something about this the other week. Angel in heaven during the tribulation in the real tabernacle in heaven. And another angel came and stood at the altar having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the Lord, and the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints ascended up before God out of the angel's hands. That's our prayers. The incense in heaven is our prayers, and they offer it before God. And again, this sweet incense, this burnt incense, it moves God. Prayers move God. Prayers move God. We can move God with our prayers. We ought to be praying. Now, Aaron, he offered incense every morning. Look at me like we probably ought to pray in the morning. They offered incense in the evening too. Probably ought to pray at night. Coral said it this way. You know, you pray in the morning and say hello to God and get a connection established, and then you shoulder the phone all day. How about this? You know, when two people are married, or maybe they're getting close to that, they're getting close to the point of marriage, and they have to, maybe they're in the military or something, they're separated. You know what to do? They write these love letters. Write things that you'd never write anybody else. And if anybody ever said you wrote it, you'd deny it. So, you know, you write all things, and you know what happens to the person on the other end? They read that, you know, it's a sweet savor. It moves us. And we don't just read it once. Yeah, every time we think, oh, man, that letter, let me read that one more time. Our prayers that go before God, they move God. We need to be consistent about our prayer life before God, because, again, it's like a sweet incense that goes before God, and it moves God. Now, in the millennial temple, again, there's going to be no golden altar. Why? Because Jesus is there. We talked about the couple of those apart. When they get back together, they don't write those letters generally. I mean, sometimes guys write poems for the wife on Valentine's Day. But other than that, we don't usually write those because we talk. We say those things in the privacy between us because we don't want nobody else hearing to say those things. Well, when we pray, it's like a sweet incense. And again, the burnt offering and the burnt incense, that word burnt. And Barnes has this idea that has to do with the aroma that comes up that moves God, and so we can move God with our prayer. So, but there won't be any golden altar incense there because Jesus himself will be there and we can walk right up to him. So anyway, I hope that's a blessing to you. It was a blessing to me as we were studying that out. And don't forget to pray. Live your life like you're supposed to. Be that sweet scent amongst everybody around you. and thank God for Jesus, the offering, the sweet-smelling savor, the offering of himself that moved God so we could be saved. What a blessing, all right? So let's go and pray, and then we'll be in here by another, look like, 15 minutes. Father, I ask you to bless what's been said. Help us to appreciate you and all your goodness and greatness and godliness and this idea, especially about this sweet savor that you are before the Father, so that we can be saved. We're thankful. Bless us now as we go along the rest of the day. In Jesus' name I pray.